I was ridiculed on every late night talk show for 25 years and tabloid covers for 25 years. Here are just a few of the thousands of headlines written about me. Oprah, fatter than ever. Oprah hits 246 pounds. Final showdown with Stedman sends her into feeding frenzy. Oprah warned, diet or die.
Oprah Winfrey last week during a special she hosted about the rise of weight loss drugs and the stigma surrounding being overweight. One drug in particular has captured the public conversation, the diabetes drug Ozempic. It's not approved by the FDA to treat weight loss, but it's become a major trend and a billion-dollar industry. New analysis from the Kaiser Family Foundation says Medicare spending on Ozempic and drugs like it is up from around $60 million in 2018 to nearly $6 billion, with a B, in 2022. Juliette Kubanski is the deputy director of the Program on Medicare Policy at the Kaiser Family Foundation and one of the authors of the study. Juliette, welcome.
Hi, Jonathan. How are you?
Well, thank you. All right. So that increase in Medicare spending on these drugs for diabetes is huge. What accounts for that?
Well, look, there's a tremendous demand for these medications as diabetes medications. Diabetes is a very common chronic condition among, you know, all people, including people who are covered by Medicare. So, you know, what we're seeing is just tremendous demand for this newer generation of these diabetes products. And so I think it's really notable that we're also talking about these drugs as weight loss medications, but Medicare doesn't actually cover weight loss medications. So the spending that we're observing is their use as diabetes drugs.
I mean, it's interesting you say that because I think anecdotally, we hear about this mostly as a weight loss medication, but you're saying it's not covered by Medicare. I mean, do you get a sense that perhaps the drug is also being prescribed, you know, for weight-related issues, even if it's not the kind of what they would think of as the number one cause?
Well, we do know that there is a fair amount of this so-called off-label prescribing of these medications for use as obesity treatments. But we've actually looked at the numbers in the Medicare data. And, you know, what we see is that people who are using these medications in Medicare, the vast majority of them, I mean, like 99% of them, all have diabetes. So we're pretty sure that this off-label prescribing is not happening in the Medicare population, but it is definitely happening outside of Medicare.
These drugs, as we know, are incredibly popular, but talk about just safety. I mean, we hear about side effects, but how do you understand the safety of a drug like Ozempic?
Yeah, that is certainly a concern. I think, you know, one of the issues is that you know, these medications do have side effects, and specifically in the older population, I think there is a concern that when used for weight loss, people will lose fat, but they also may lose muscle. And if we're talking about an older population that may already be, you know, at risk of falling, you know, losing muscle mass is I think a real concern for the older population. And the other reality is that these drugs, when taken for weight loss, need to be taken over a long period of time, or the weight will just come back on. So, you know, not only does that, you know, leave people, you know, potentially exposed to the side effects of these medications, but it also means that we're just going to be spending a lot of money consistently over time.
And I know that's one big concern of people who take a drug like this, is that they don't want to be on a drug forever. And that's how we're starting to understand these things. Do you think that's also a problem?
It may be a problem. You know, we know that, you know, historically, I think people tend to, you know, maybe not adhere to their medication regimens as tightly as their doctors might like. But I think with these medications in particular, certainly in the context of their use as weight loss medications, you know, I think people who want to take them to lose weight may be more willing to, you know, comply because they want to keep that weight off. But again, you know, back to this question of side effects, whether people are able to tolerate those side effects over the long term, I think is a question that we still don't have great answers to yet.
Yeah, and it's worth, I mean, some people report anxiety, depression, or suicidal ideation. So, I mean, you know, these are things that sounds like they need to be taken seriously. But how affordable are these drugs currently? I mean, how much more affordable could they get with FDA approval?
Yeah, well, certainly if you don't have coverage for these medications, you're looking at, you know, out-of-pocket costs of oh, well over $10,000 for a year of the medication. So without coverage, these drugs are pretty much unaffordable for most people. You know, even with insurance coverage, though, because these drugs have relatively high list prices, if your insurance charges you a flat dollar copayment, you know, maybe you can afford the out-of-pocket cost if it's $50 or $100 a month. But some people are going to face coinsurance, which is a percentage of the drug's list price. And in that case, people could be facing out-of-pocket costs of hundreds of dollars a month. And again, those costs are likely to be unaffordable for a lot of people, even with the coverage that they have.
Just lastly, what kind of strain do you think this puts on the Medicare system? I mean, now that we're into the billions of dollars of spending, does this create any kind of long-term systemic problems?
Well, let me note that the total spending amounts that we showed in our analysis don't include any rebates that might be negotiated between pharmacy benefit managers and the manufacturers of these drugs. And those rebates could help to lower the price of the drug and mean that Medicare is actually spending somewhat less than the numbers that we presented in our analysis. But even if there are substantial rebates on these drugs, we're still talking about billions of dollars in spending on these medications and not in the context of these drugs as obesity treatments. So if Medicare coverage does expand to cover these drugs for weight loss, then we're definitely looking at, you know, billions of dollars in additional spending. And that's not you know, that's not just going to be a one and done kind of spending effect. Because these drugs need to be taken over a longer term. So, you know, it does put strain on Medicare spending. At the same time, obesity is, you know, a serious problem. And if there are, you know, effective treatments as these are for weight loss, I think it's important to make sure that people on Medicare as well as other people have access to these medications. We just need to figure out how to deal with the spending problem.
We've been talking with Juliette Kubanski. She's a deputy director of the program on Medicare policy at the Kaiser Family Foundation. Juliette, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, Hollywood Boulevard might be a famous tourist trap, but it doesn't have the best reputation among locals. A new city project aims to make it a more walk-and-friendly area. Also, how do we build community in this age of isolation and have it feel authentic? Our guest says it takes dedicated work, but the benefits far outweigh the costs. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Jonathan Bastian in for Madeline Brand. Hollywood's Walk of Fame is about to get a little more walk in it. Two LA City Council members recently proposed renovating a 3-mile stretch of Hollywood Boulevard. They want to widen sidewalks, take out traffic lanes, and make it more bike-friendly. The goal is to make the iconic boulevard safer and more desirable for both tourists and residents. Rachel Aranga covers transportation and mobility for the LA Times, and she joins me now to tell us more. Hey, Rachel, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so for those who are unfamiliar, can you describe and just kind of give us a taste of Hollywood Boulevard? There's the Walk of Fame, the Chinese Theater, but it also doesn't have the best reputation among locals, right?
Sure. I mean, people even there say, look, Hollywood Boulevard is a little gritty. The streets, if you go down in front of the Grauman's Chinese, you'll see a lot of tourists, people gawking, and sometimes you see a lot of performers out there who are maybe asking for a buck or two in exchange for a picture. They might be dressed in superhero costumes. Yeah, and it just doesn't have sort of the pizzazz and glare and glamour that you see on the red carpet.
Right. All right. Well, let's talk about then why there's plans to kind of clean this up. So this Access to Hollywood project is really, it's an amalgamation of previous city attempts to redesign Hollywood Boulevard. So what does this plan do that those don't already do?
Well, I think what this plan does is it just basically puts the two together. Overall, there's been a lot of pressure on the city to make streets slower and reduce traffic lanes in certain parts of the city and add wider sidewalks, bring in bike lanes, and so forth. So the councilman from this district said, "Hey, like, let's get it together. Let's get a push on these, and let's get this done." And so it's a 3.6 mile stretch. It would take out two traffic lanes, and it would leave a middle lane, like that turn lane, and then a traffic lane on each side. So driving through the area would actually probably be a little bit slower. In one section, it adds about a mile of bus lane that is shared with bikers. And it also adds throughout the 3.6 miles a bike lane. So you could actually take your bike through there. You might be able to go up. There's a Hollywood and Vine station. You can take the metro there, get on your bike, and roll around up and down that street, which is a really big departure from what it is now. I mean, if you go out there now and just kind of stand and look, it's five lanes. As one woman described it, it's almost like a thoroughfare right through the middle of Hollywood. I mean, it does not feel intimate, as I think most people expect when they go down to Hollywood Boulevard. If you're from out of town, they expect it to feel a little bit more intimate, and it's not.
Yeah, no, of course. And I mean, do you see this as just a much larger trend in trying to kind of walkify LA, get people on their bikes, make these spaces just feel a little bit more shared and public?
Yeah, sure. I mean, we saw that in March with HLA, which was a measure that was put on the ballot, in which Los Angelenos voted to approve a city mobility plan that would require hundreds of miles of bike lanes across the city. It would also add more bus lanes. And it's just really a larger push to get away from car-centric Los Angeles, where the best way to get everywhere is in your automobile, and really trying to push people to get out into the street, walk the streets, take mass transit, and find another way to get around the city, which is, decidedly hard in a sprawling metropolis.
Yeah, and my experience kind of watching these measures come up, not just in LA, but anywhere, is they always sound like really good on paper and people really seem to be behind them. But then for those that actually live in these neighborhoods, there's major pushback. For example, we're talking 200 less parking spaces. And I know this might seem kind of funny, but people riot over parking spaces when they're lost. And I'm curious, like, what you think, will there be blowback in this area, or do the vendors think this is also a good idea?
Well, look, I don't think everyone is on board with this. I mean, there are some people in Hollywood who really like it, and there's others who don't. After we wrote the article, we got a note from the chief executive of Star Trek Tours, who's out there, and he said, "Look, you do not need to create more space in Hollywood and Highland. These larger sidewalks aren't needed for the boulevard, and removing parking is going to decimate the tour industry." There is a lot of pushback, and history has shown in Los Angeles that certain neighborhoods and certain individuals don't like street parking taken away. They don't want their cars to have smaller streets because then it's slower. And yeah, like you say, it sounds good, but when it comes down to it and you're in a hurry, people don't want to be bothered with this more intimate, walkable space. And it's part of the reason that for a long time, even though Los Angeles had plans to implement these kinds of thing in other parts of the city, city council members wound up not moving forward because they didn't want the blowback from constituents.
It also makes me wonder, let's say, for example, you could open this area up to more bikers and more people on foot. I mean, is there hope that there would be a ripple effect and then the area might get nicer? Like there might be an influx of, I don't know, newer shops or maybe less unhoused people there, which is another complaint of the area. I mean, does one follow the other as one might hope?
Well, that's the hope. Like we talked about earlier, this was a sort of amalgamation of two different projects. One of them was this Walk of Fame project. And when that was unveiled a couple years ago by a different council member, there were plans for street furniture and wider sidewalks. But I think they scaled back that street furniture plan just if for exactly what you're talking about. They didn't want the homeless population to come up there and find new bedding for them instead of inviting tourists. But the social realities of Los Angeles is that, you're in a homeless crisis and people will panhandle where they want, or they'll use this opportunistically.
Yeah, of course. Well, I'll run us through just a little bit of the numbers here in terms of cost. And how does the city actually plan to pay for this?
Sure. Okay. So the portion west of Gower is a $6.7 million project. And that is being money set aside for the Metropolitan Transportation Authorities. They have an active transportation program. And that is really to encourage these kind of what they call complete streets, streets that make room for things beyond cars, including pedestrians, bicyclists, et cetera. And then the portion east of Gower is going to be co costing around $1 million. And a lot of that money actually came from Vision Zero. I don't know if you recall that, but the previous mayor, Eric Garcetti, had really touted Vision Zero as a way to rethink our streets and reduce pedestrian deaths. Last year, more pedestrians died on the streets of Los Angeles than people murdered in homicides.
When can we expect some of these changes to take place, or are we still in like the preliminary stages of this plan? What do we know?
No, actually, a lot of these things are going to be moving forward by next year. You're going to see the bike lanes by next year, and even some of the restriping. There's some portions of the plan that need to go through an environmental process, but it's very little. It's just some of the structural things that they're going to add more trees and so forth. But a large portion of this will get done by next year.
We've been speaking with Rachel Aranga, staff writer at the LA Times. Thanks so much for joining us and for the information. We appreciate it.
All right, thank you.
It's been a year since LA County returned a strand of Manhattan Beach waterfront property to the descendants of the Bruce family. Known as Bruce's Beach, the land was taken from the family nearly 100 years ago through eminent domain. Now, Santa Monica faces a similar issue. Last week, the city council voted to explore compensating the descendants of a black man named Silas White for his plot of land on Ocean Avenue near Pico Boulevard. Decades ago, White dreamed of converting an old building into the Ebony Beach Club, a place where African Americans could feel safe from discrimination while at the beach in Santa Monica. The city took the land, saying they needed it for public parking. And now the luxury Viceroy Hotel sits on the site. Joining us to talk about Silas White and the Ebony Beach Club is Allison Rose Jefferson. She's a historian and author of Living the California Dream: African American Leisure Sites During the Jim Crow Era. Allison, welcome.
Hello there. How are you, Jonathan?
I'm doing great. Thanks for being with us. So give us some background here. Who was Silas White?
Well, Silas White was an African American man who was an entrepreneur who moved to Santa Monica in the 1920s. He started, among other businesses, the Ebony Beach Club in the 1950s, and that was on some property that he bought in 1957, and he had a white partner that he was working with where the Viceroy is today. He saw it as a place for elite African American leisure. And one of the first people that signed up for the club was the famed singer Nat King Cole. And with that, he envisioned that they would have this place to meet for socializing, as well as have a place where they could change their clothes, going to the beach. They would organize various kinds of social trips revolving around California coastal outdoor activities, such as ocean fishing trips. He was thinking of this as someplace that would have been small, but still in keeping with what some of the other beach clubs were offering to people that were white, that Black people couldn't go to during that time period.
Interesting. Well, let's actually just talk about that area for a second here. What was the racial makeup of Santa Monica years ago? And I mean, how common was it for a Black family in the 1950s to own this prime real estate in Santa Monica?
Well, there's always been an African-American community in Santa Monica. There is the historic African-American church that's at 4th and Bay that was established at that site in 1908. And there were residents of that of the African-American community that lived there and right behind where or just east of where Silas White purchased his property in the area that the Civic Auditorium is today. And then there were other African-American families that had lived just to the north of the high school who were pushed out with the freeway and the high school expansion. So there's always been some African-American residency there and in other places in Santa Monica. We have to remember that development looks different today than it did when African-Americans were initially setting up their residency and attempting to set up businesses there. This was the edge of Ocean Park at that point in time, where we're talking about where Silas White was trying to build his beach club, where the church established itself, and where some other businesses attempted to establish themselves around beach culture that were pushed out due to racism of Santa Monica's white business class.
Right. Well, we mentioned Bruce's Beach Club just at the top of this segment, and a lot of our listeners may be familiar with this, but talk about how that might have set a precedent here. I mean, can you imagine this case going through if it wasn't for the Bruce Beach settlement?
I think that the Bruce's Beach family settlement was very instrumental in setting the tone for Ms. White and her family members to be able to pursue restitution of their family's land loss in Santa Monica. These kinds of stories have been overlooked in the past, and they're now getting more recognition for a variety of reasons. In this particular case, they're getting recognition, both Bruce's Beach and the Ebony Beach Club, on a broader level because there's money involved in it. And so, you know, we've been working on commemoration of these sites and recognition of these sites and honoring the people who fought for and struggled for their civil rights and for California freedoms in terms of enjoying outdoor space for the last, since with the research and various projects that I've been involved in and others have been involved with to make sure that this these stories don't get lost in terms of our shared collective history here in California and the nation.
Yeah, well, clearly really important work. And I'm wondering, what's the next step for the Santa Monica City Council now that they voted to consider compensating Silas White's descendants?
Well, at this point, in terms of my understanding of what the City Council is planning to do, they are going to have the City Council's research team, which would be staff of the city, do some research into the situation. I don't know what they've read or haven't read. I saw the documents that were attached to the motion at the City Council. So they have pulled up a few newspaper articles that they found on the 1950s dispossession. And so they have city records that they potentially could go back and find. And then they will come up with some sort of determination of what they think might be appropriate in terms of some sort of compensation to the White family.
And I know that this is maybe impossible for you to predict, but I mean, the sums of money here are not insignificant. We're talking millions or tens of millions of dollars if, for example, we follow the Bruce Beach settlement. Do you think that's in the ballpark of something that could happen here?
I have no idea of what's in the ballpark. It could be financial. It could be through land. this is just one of a series of more contemporary restitution activities that are happening for individuals that are meaningful to the individuals, and they are meaningful to looking at a broader way of making amends to African Americans for all the redlining practices that inhibited African Americans wealth building and community building in places like Santa Monica and other places around the United States.
I've been speaking with Allison Rose Jefferson, a historian and the author of Living the California Dream, African American Leisure Sites During the Jim Crow Era. Allison, thanks for the time. We appreciate the conversation.
Thank you, Jonathan, for your interest in the story.
Coming up tomorrow on Press Play, there's been a lot of research that shows smartphone and social media have caused an alarming spike in depression, anxiety, and suicide among American teens. We'll hear from a researcher from the book The Anxious Generation. But first, how do we define isolation and loneliness?
Social isolation is the time we spend by ourselves. Loneliness is the quality of our experience of connection. And both of those are going up.
The importance of community in the age of loneliness. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Jonathan Bastian, in for Madeline Brand. Throughout history, humans have formed tribes, clans, villages, social groups created by a common bond. For centuries, it was automatic. People were born into their communities. Flash forward to today, transient lifestyles, smaller families, and increased secularism have led to the slow dissolution of those very structures that nurtured and supported us. Now, the freedoms and independence we crave bumps right up against our need to connect, to talk, and rely on each other. Turns out being together these days is very much on our terms, when, how, and if we like it. Casper Ter Kuile is the author of The Power of Ritual and co-founder of Nearness, a digital community of people exploring life's big questions through deep conversations. I spoke with him earlier this month and began by asking him how he defines community.
I think for me, community is a set of relationships in which I am known and I know the other people. My colleagues at Sacred Design Lab talk about community washing, right? This idea that everyone's selling community, but it's not really real.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
And so, yeah, I think one of the ways you can kind of test for community is if you don't show up, do people notice that you're not there? And do they care enough to reach out to you to check in on you?
Where did community used to come from? My sense is this answer might take us to old traditions. I mean, religion certainly served that purpose for hundreds or thousands of years, didn't it?
No doubt. And, you know, we talk a lot about building community, but certainly in more traditional structures of life in ye olden days, you know, you were just born into community. It just existed. You didn't have to set about trying to create it because you were born into structures of belonging. That often meant the family primarily, but certainly also geographical boundaries, right? You belong to a village or to a tribe or to a city. And then there were those additional structures, religious structures, civic structures. And I think we might look to religion, especially because the kind of congregation as a unit of community is still one that we recognize, even if maybe some of those other structures of a large extended family or a living in a town, as you have done for generations, that's kind of just no longer part of our experience. But certainly religious communities of all stripes have been vital, in part because I think they fulfill a function of community that we might not immediately think of, which is helping people feel part of a larger story. And I think what these stories do is they pull us out of our immediate self-interest. They pull us out of our limited frame of reference of just thinking about our to-do list and our responsibilities and what we want, and that there are different priorities for us and our collective when we look at that bigger story. So, you know, in an individualistic frame, you might spend most of your time thinking about how do I get ahead, or, you know, how do I get that the thing that I want? And when you're looking at that bigger story, you're thinking about, you know, how do we pass on the gifts that we've been given? How do we tend for the whole? What do we need to do today to ensure that the next generation will be safe and well? You know, the nuclear family is perhaps one of the few remaining structures where we really identify ourselves as part of something bigger. But, you know, as is well documented at this point, it's nearly impossible to raise kids with two parents working, let alone one parent. You know, those that structure of community is too small to serve our well-being. We need those larger structures to be healthy and well.
Mm. I think of the people, including myself, right, that have moved to a different town in the pandemic. I work alone throughout the days. Yeah. I know so many people that have kind of had to start from scratch rebuilding, because we get, you know, allured into new places we want to be and experience. And then I think a lot of people realize when they get somewhere new, they're like, oh my God, I actually don't know anyone. Like the luster of just the physical environment, yes, can wear off when the people aren't there to support you. That being so, remote work, the lack of religious structures, the idea that, you know, geographically families are just so spread out these days, right? So just to kind of finish that side, you would agree, I take it, that like we are at a kind of fascinating moment of loneliness.
Absolutely. And the data backs this up. You know, there are two indicators here that are worth paying attention to. The first is social isolation. And that is the way in which we structurally spend more time by ourselves. And you mentioned a couple of them. We're working from home more. More of us are unpartnered or marry at a later age. But then the second indicator is our experience of loneliness is also increasing. Now, loneliness is the emotional experience we have of our connections, even when we're with other people. Mm. So if you've ever been to a party and there's plenty of people around, but you're kind of sitting there by yourself wondering, like, what am I doing here? That's a moment of loneliness. So social isolation is the time we spend by ourselves. Loneliness is the quality of our experience of connection. And both of those are going up. And so you're absolutely right. The Surgeon General's talked about a pandemic of loneliness, right? Mm-hmm. This very intense experience that, something is not quite right. And you mentioned moving to a new town. You know, I did the same thing. My husband and I moved to Brooklyn, New York, a few months before the pandemic, not knowing that that was coming. Mm. And, you know, we spent a good 2 years really being pretty isolated. And it took a few weeks before Christmas where I said, I really don't want to spend Christmas alone, right? We have to find someone to spend it with. And we had met this other couple, honestly, 2 or 3 times, but we liked them. They were Jewish, so we knew they'd be free. So we said, hey, would you, you know, we texted that kind of first date style text. Would you be willing to pod with us over Christmas? So, you know, we all isolated for a good 10 days and then got together. And what was so beautiful out of that was a weekly dinner and card game night, which lasted for a good 5 months, which, if you live in New York City, you do not see the same people every week for 5 months. It's extremely rare. And what came out of that was this beautiful friendship between the four of us that has really just flourished in a post-pandemic life too. And so I think you're so right that you have to kind of create those structures of community to support yourself, because it doesn't just happen. Because in so much of the modern world, you know, the ways in which you might have made conversation with people are increasingly disappearing as we design all of our systems, especially through technology, for efficiency. You know, you being able to order your food and it being delivered, using a self-checkout machine at the grocery store, all sorts of ways in which life becomes more streamlined, more efficient. What is efficiency but taking away relationship, right? Mm. The chance for a conversation at the checkout counter, having to go outside and running into your neighbor and saying hello. All of those things are kind of being eliminated from our everyday. And so, yeah, we're spending more and more of our time by ourselves.
And I think it's important to say that we live under this idea of quote unquote connectivity, right? In a sense that we're always kind of vaguely talking to each other via text or social media or whatever it is.
We're lurking, aren't we? It's not really connection. It's mostly observing. And if you're anything like me, a little bit envying, right?
So sure, of course.
We're consuming content on a YouTube or a TikTok, or we're kind of just like lurking and seeing these other people that we might have met 3 years ago at a conference posting about whatever's happening in their life on LinkedIn. And so it's like the fast food version of connection. It's like you get this hit, but it's actually not very fulfilling.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've used the word that we need to create structures to situate community. We need reasons to be accountable. And I know this has just been a big part of what you've been thinking about and designing. So welcome us a little bit to the ideas that you have been kind of working with in terms of trying to recreate some of the things that it seems like we really are missing.
Well, you're right. I've become a little bit obsessed with this. and it's because I really, really believe that if it's just left to our own choices, we're going to fall short. And so we need help. And that help comes from the structures that will hold us in relationship. We've talked about a congregation as one example. I think often having hundreds of people in the same place can still leave us feeling a little bit lost and lonely, especially if we're there for the first time. Yeah. And so I've been really interested in units of belonging at a smaller level. So somewhere between 4 people up to 12 and maybe even a little larger. And you see this in a lot of recovery communities, of course, religious communities too, might have covenant groups or something like that. But what I've been thinking about is how can we help people into that kind of committed relationship for a certain amount of time to live life and accompany one another. And so with this project called Nearness, what we've been building are small groups of accompaniment over an 8 to 10 week journey. So you sign up, you get matched with 5 or 6 other people, you meet every week for 90 minutes on Zoom and go through a very beautifully structured set of reflection questions and a kind of mindfulness practices together that really build the experience of deep connection. And having that commitment of saying, hey, I'm going to show up every week at the same time with the same people for these rich conversations means that over time, people really quickly go deep together. Even though we're very different, there's an experience of living life together in a way that's really meaningful.
I feel that the importance of the small group is actually quite vital here, but I'm going to let you talk about that because like I come at this often as a therapist where I think of group therapy, right? And yeah. And you don't want like 40 people in a room. That's not very helpful. It's more
it's kind of overwhelming.
Yeah. It's overwhelming. Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there needs to be some aspect of intimacy, right? Of safety and of like your voice actually does matter. What are ways that you would suggest starting to create these groups? I mean, obviously people can join the program that you have done, but like what are other principles that we can draw from that for, you know, people that do feel isolated, that are have moved somewhere new? Where does one begin with this stuff?
Well, it's not easy. So first, if you're feeling that, I feel you, it's tough. And you've got to be brave. And so when you feel brave, take one step and introduce yourself to your neighbor. It's a weird moment. And if you've moved somewhere recently, it's the perfect time to do it. I did it in my building. Mm. And people are kind of like, why are you saying hello?
Yeah.
But just swapping numbers. And I use the excuse that my husband plays piano. So I was like, if it's ever too loud, please let me know.
Oh,
so
brilliant.
You know, find some sort of excuse. And so, you know, those little kind of cultures of belonging will start to grow with that committed recurrence of connecting with each other.
Do you feel that there are naturally other groups that tend to form community faster? I mean, we can acknowledge that we're two white guys talking here, right? But maybe different genders or marginalized communities, is that something that you've noticed?
That's a great question. Certainly when people have a shared experience, it fast-tracks connection. And so if you're a woman in a male-dominated workplace and you're having lunch with another woman, there is plenty to talk about, right? And you might have some shared interests as well as such kind of shared interests that you want to achieve together in addition to the shared experiences or shared identities. So one way I might think about this is, what do you want to create, right? Do you want to have a street party, or do you want to have a chance to learn how to make watercolors? Whatever it is, you want to have a pickup basketball game, finding other people who want to create something similar is a great way to really build a strong relationship. If you have that shared direction of travel, that shared desire to create something, that's a great way to connect with someone quickly.
Well, we'll begin to wrap this up. And I just want to kind of ask if, you know, what else has been on your mind in this process, or what have you seen in these small groups that you have created that's maybe surprised you in certain ways, that's given you hope or maybe given you more questions? How's it kind of all going, this idea of trying to bring people together at this point?
You know, one of the things I've enjoyed so much is that people finish their small group time and say, my husband just told me I listened to him differently. Like, my colleagues just said how patient I was. And so what I want to say is that these small groups are not just ends in themselves, but they're also practice grounds for how we might show up in every other relationship that we have. Because each time that we're intentionally cultivating that listening presence, or we're being more patient when someone is struggling to articulate what they think or feel or have experienced, That's a way in which we are formed then to go out into the world and be that more patient, present kind of person. So I think we're always being formed in one way or another, and these small groups are an opportunity to really be choiceful in who we want to become.
That's Casper Ter Kuile. He's the author of the book, The Power of Ritual, and co-founder of Nearness. That's a digital community of people exploring life's big questions through deep conversations. You can hear our entire conversation on KCRW's Life Examined. Find it at kcrw.com/lifeexamined. Coming up, before you just toss broccoli that's turned yellow into the trash, Evan Kleiman has some ideas for flowering vegetables. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Jonathan Bastian, in for Madeline Brand. Spring has officially sprung, which means it's an exciting and colorful time at the farmer's market. KCRW's Good Food recently came across some show-stopping flowering vegetables at the Santa Monica Farmer's Market. And host Evan Kleiman is here to talk about what they found. Hey, Evan.
Hey, Jonathan, how are you?
Good. Good to hear your voice. Well, let's start with a little science here. Why do we differentiate between fruits and vegetables? They're all parts of plants with roots and stems and seeds, right?
Yeah, you know, I thought a lot about this, actually. And I think ultimately we decided to categorize them differently because of the sweetness of fruit in comparison to what we call vegetables, which have many more green and bitter notes. But the idea of fruits and vegetables are related to flowers. And I say idea because these are not scientific categories, they're botanical categories. We differentiate these plants in ways that are somewhat arbitrary from an eating standpoint. Fruit is categorized botanically as something that grows from the flower of a plant, while all other plant parts are categorized as vegetables.
Right. Okay. I feel like I'm getting a lesson I should have had as a kid here, but I appreciate this, Evan. So do all vegetables flower? How do we understand this?
I dislike the word all because there will always be an exception, but generally most do. I mean, if you have ever gardened, planted vegetables in your garden, especially the herb cilantro, you will know that plants get a signal to reproduce, which in their world means flower. And when you're a gardener, you often see a vegetable bolt, which means that a big stalk comes up from the center of the plant and it starts to flower, which signals the end of its life cycle. But there is still opportunity for eaters. The flowers taste like the vegetables they're from, but some often have this overlay of sweetness or even a slight bitterness, which can be appealing.
Yeah. All right. So which vegetables actually produce flowers that are edible and maybe most importantly, actually taste good, like we'd want to eat them?
It's a huge list, much bigger than you would ever imagine. And I actually have a link to a wiki page on the website that people can go look at. I have a video up on our website and also on Instagram of just what one Santa Barbara farm, Coleman Family Farms, is offering this week at market stands. There's flowering cilantro, wood sorrel, arugula, mustard, white and blue borage, not to mention some fruit flowers like peach blossoms. And remember, you see banana blossoms at Thai stores. There's flowers all around you. Don't throw away the broccoli that you might have in your fridge once it starts to get these little yellow flowers. If it still smells good.
All right. Still edible. Well, then why is it that the produce sold to us in supermarkets is usually, you know, one or two parts of the plant with the rest just lopped off? I mean, I guess there's exceptions of carrots, beets, radishes, maybe?
You mean with the leaves and the tops? I just think that it's less trash for the grocer to get rid of, the middleman. At farmers markets, you generally see them mostly intact. And I think we've all learned so much about food waste by now that we know that many of those tops are edible. I mean, even broccoli and cauliflower, which essentially are immature flowers in and of themselves, you can eat those leaves. I mean, I always just add the leaves into whatever I'm making with those vegetables.
So there's a lot of good options, but are there anything that we should try and avoid? Maybe vegetable flowers that are poisonous should be avoided? I mean, if the roots or stems are edible, is the whole plant safe to eat?
Not necessarily. For example, potato plant leaves are considered to be poisonous. I wouldn't eat those flowers. Some people are very hesitant to eat tomato leaves, so perhaps I wouldn't eat tomato flowers. But I would refer to that wiki because there are many, many more than one imagines. And there's so many things you can do with them because they are so beautiful. I mean, one of these days, it's my goal, maybe I'll do it this year, to actually make a salad that is made up of only flowering plant tops. So all the mustards, the borage, which tastes like cucumbers, the radish flowers, which are spicy. I mean, there's so many things you can do. We have a recipe over on the Good Food page for a broccoli wrap borage cream cheese spread from local author Rose Wild. And I just think it's such a wonderful way to celebrate for the Easter and Passover holidays, to just include some of these flowering plant materials in your food. And I give you options and ideas on the website.
No, that's awesome. And I mean, to me, it's just a reminder for anyone listening to do a little bit of research about this stuff with the amount of options. So let's talk about what to do with some of these flowers. Do you have any more ideas to share?
So to me, like a no-brainer is if you're making hand rolls or spring rolls, just roll them in with a little bit of the tender stems, like arugula flowers or radish or mustard flowers. Any of them would be just delicious that way. You can also work the flowers into butters, make compound butters. Radish would be particularly good for steak or chicken, or just to slather on a delicious baguette for a sandwich. Rosemary flowers worked into a compound butter, maybe with a little bit of shallot, would be good for steak or chicken. And then there are, for example, there are bok choy in the market now that are flowering. So anything that you usually cook, you just cook it like you normally would, but you get this bonus of beauty of these flowers.
I love that. And I mean, one of the takeaways to me here is just to be a little more thoughtful of the various stages of the plant we go through. And if we can, use as much of the plant as possible before just tossing stuff in the compost bin.
Exactly. At least here in the U.S., I really believe we tend to be overly cautious when it comes to deciding when vegetables are no longer of use. Just take a beat, think, and smell before you throw something away.
And I mean, finally, and perhaps a recurring theme, just shopping at our local farmers markets, right?
Yeah. I mean, you talk so much about people's emotional well-being. And I have to say that going to the farmers markets any time of year, but I think spring in particular is one of the greatest mood boosters you could ever give yourself.
Well, of course, a whole other topic here, the psychology of being around beautiful things and wonderful plants and being outside. We know that does boost happiness, something you're around all the time, right?
Yeah, it's and community, a really lovely community.
That's right. Well, you can see some of the flowers we talked about in Good Foods video that's posted at kcrw.com, also on Instagram at kcrwgoodfood. Evan Kleiman hosts KCRW's Good Food. You can listen on Saturday mornings at 10. Subscribe to the podcast and Evan's newsletter at kcrw.com/goodfood. So, Evan, what's on Good Food this week?
In honor of the renewal of spring, we go deep into eggs. So we talked to a journalist who explored why egg yolks are getting more orange. And we explore the Filipino treat, balut, and more. So many more egg stories.
All right. Sounds wonderful. Evan, thank you so much for the time, as usual.
Thank you, Jonathan. It's been lovely speaking with you.
That does it for Press Play. Don't forget to follow us on socials at KCRW. You can download or subscribe to the Press Play podcast at kcrw.com. I'm Jonathan Bastian, in for Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening today. I'll be back tomorrow.